Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and my guest is Christopher Clary, who's been the New York Times tennis correspondent for 30 years, and he's the author of The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer. Christopher, I've been a big admirer of your work all these years. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
And it's always good to see you. Thanks a lot.
I've been a big admirer of Roger Federer as well and had the opportunity to interview him years ago when he won his 5 straight U.S. Open titles. And reading your book, you know, a lot of the similar thoughts came into my mind about Roger Federer, the fact that he just seemed so nice and so down to earth despite his extraordinary success. And I love the quote about Roger that Paul Annacone said in your intro. He said, the reason Roger is so interesting is because he's so interested. And I think that's huge because he really cares about other people and he really is so interested in other people.
You know, I think a lot of that comes from how we're raised, right? The kind of childhood we have, our parents and how they emphasize certain things. And I think that's the way it was with Roger. I don't think he was raised to think he was, you know, the center of the universe by his parents anyway, at least compared to a lot of superstar athletes and tennis players. And it's an individual sport. It's a Darwinian sport, and no doubt about it. So you're going to have an ego. You have to. But I've noticed Roger over the years. I've had a chance to, you know, cover him for 20-plus years now as a pro player. And I feel like he's a guy who has learned, or maybe not even learned, maybe it's just innate, to get the best out of each situation that he's in. There's a lot of things that are drudgery for tennis players. You know, press conferences, a lot of guys don't enjoy those, the travel, the jet lag, the sponsor commitments. And maybe Roger deep down doesn't enjoy those things, but he does an awfully good impression of somebody who does and finds a way to get value out of his contacts with people. And you can just be around him. He's an extrovert. He likes people. He gets energy from them. And I think I've heard enough stories anecdotally from people about his ability to just meet up anybody and ask them questions about their life. Paul Annacone had a friend in the construction business, and he was talking to Roger, introduced Roger to this guy, and the guy was a little starstruck, obviously, and Roger's like quizzing him on the construction business. So how do you do that? You know, how does it work for you? You know, you get your deals done. And the guy was blown away by the fact that Roger wanted to know all about his business. That's just the way he operates. And I think it does set him apart, and I think it's part of the reason he's lasted so long in the career, which can be a grind.
I remember interviewing him at the Carlisle Hotel. So we're in this, like, ultra-plush luxury hotel, and there's Roger just being very down-to-earth and very normal. And you described Roger as having an air of normalcy amid the extraordinary, which I think is perfect because we certainly were in an extraordinary place and he seemed so normal. And all your encounters with him, he was just a normal guy.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I mean, obviously, he's not just a normal guy. And he also knows, I think, the power of his celebrity. He's well aware of that. And he also has realized over time that, you know, tennis makes you a lot of money. The guy's made $1 billion probably in all his different deals over the years, the first tennis player to do that. So we shouldn't go overboard on the everyman thing. But within that context, I think he's somebody who, very relatable, and I don't think he really wants to be on a pedestal when he's with the, you know, people he's coming across. I think he knows where he's, what he's earned. He's happy with that status, but he's somebody who's able to kind of, I think, adapt, empathize, and relate to people across the whole spectrum.
Let's talk first about Roger Federer as a tennis player, winner of 20 Grand Slam titles. Many consider him to be the GOAT. The greatest of all time, a debate that is ongoing, certainly with Rafael Nadal at 20 and Novak Djokovic also at 20. We'll see what happens at the U.S. Open with Djokovic. But talk about Roger Federer as a tennis player. What makes him so extraordinary?
Well, I think with Roger, it's for a long time in his pro career, he's made it look pretty easy. People watch him play because of his, you know, sort of the natural grace he has. The way his shots are technically very strong and perfect, and also the way he finishes his shots in. If you watch him play tennis or look at photographs of him, you always see when the ball's gone, his eyes are still on the contact point. I mean, nobody else does that. It actually comes from his boyhood coach, Peter Carter, I learned when I was researching this book, which I thought was fascinating. That's the only other guy I've ever heard of who did that. And it gives his shots this sort of balletic finish to it, you know? And I think that really is appealing to people. But I think also the guy's got a lot of grit. And that's something I really got to appreciate, you know, researching the book a bit more, having covered him for so many years and seen, you know, a lot of times I don't think he's gotten the credit he deserves for his toughness and for his ability to make changes and improvements in his game. And he really has come a long, long way in terms of his behavior on court, in terms of his able to master himself, his ability to be able to control the things that were holding him back. But just as a pure experience, I mean, David Foster Wallace wrote a great essay in our New York Times magazine many years ago about the liquidity of Rodgers' game and just the flow of it. And it is intoxicating. And I think that's something that you can't always – I don't think you can teach that. It just is. And I think he's somebody who the fact that he learned to control his emotions, which is not his natural state. He's much more of a yeller and an emotional guy and maybe even a racket thrower deep down. But he suppressed all that. And I think that just added – a little mystique to the natural elegance of his movement and his flow of the game, and I think it added to the whole package.
Yeah, I mean, what's always impressed me about Roger is his movement, his speed. He does it so gracefully. I guess balletic is a good term. I saw that Billie Jean King described him as that as well. I just loved her quote in your book as well. And, you know, the instincts are uncanny, and you put that all together, it's the whole package.
What's interesting about this is that Marc Rosé, maybe you remember, who was the best Swiss men's player before Roger came along. He was an Olympic champion in singles kind of by surprise in Barcelona. He was talking about what made Roger special. And for him, he feels like what makes Roger different is he has something that's like processing speed, which is a fascinating thought. He's able to take the information that he sees on the field of play, in this case the court, and just interpret it with his eyes, with his sense of anticipation, and process it, which is why he always looks like he has a bit more time than other people. And he was talking about Jordan in basketball or Lionel Messi in soccer, or, you know, a great quarterback like Brady maybe even, just having that ability to process the information quickly. So I don't think Rodgers, he's not an academic guy. He left school at 16, somebody who didn't take great joy in the classroom. But he's very self-taught, but I think he's got a very quick processor in there, and his brain takes the information visually and really moves it around quickly, and I think that's been a real key to his success, too. I have no proof of this, but what Rosé said really intrigued me, and I think there's some truth in that. How do you have that extra bit of time? You can be fast, it's patient, but it's also how your brain processes it.
Right, and it's so subtle. I mean, you have to really watch him closely. You wonder, how did he just do that? What did I just miss? But it's that brain working overtime so quickly.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, having the ability to be, I mean, Roger, when you watch the early videos of him from Wimbledon when he won the juniors or when he played in the early 2000s, I mean, the speed was striking. And there's matches with Leighton Hewitt, you know, the great Australian player. He was such a feisty, fast player. And Hewitt was super speedy, too. And their matches with Roger and Leighton early on, you just are blown away by the speed. And then Nadal comes along and you see more of that. But the athleticism has to be there. You can't have great court vision and not have that speed and athleticism and succeed at the level that he did. But to have all of that made a big difference.
Of all the matches that you've covered watching Roger Federer Grand Slam matches, which one stands out most in your memory?
That's an interesting question. I mean, obviously the ones that have gotten the most attention over the years were the 2008 final against Nadal, the great match at Wimbledon when Nadal finally reeled him in and beat him there, and then the match in 2017 at the Australian Open when Roger came back from injury and he was kind of on the downslope, but he came right back, roared back, and ended up winning the Australian Open, beats Nadal in five sets in the final. And then the match at Wimbledon 2019 when he was double match point against Djokovic would have been the greatest achievement of Roger's career, and he couldn't seal the deal. I mean, basically, and he had a first serve at 40-15 on match point. Novak was leaning the wrong way. Roger hit the tape up the middle. Would have been an ace just by basically an inch. That was it. And didn't seal the deal and lost the match. So those are the three matches that come to mind right away. But there's one I would mention that I just was blown away by watching again, and that was the Aussie Open semifinal against Murat Safin, who many of your listeners probably have forgotten, who won the U.S. Open once. Amazing Russian guy, total swagger, gold chains, amazing talent. Their match in the semis that Safin ended up winning was just a tremendous moment. I was there in the stadium that night. I remember just took me hours to come down after I wrote, before I got to sleep, because there was just so much adrenaline and great tennis in that match.
When I was looking at the head-to-heads, you know, first of all, we've been so blessed to have the big three, right? Federer and Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal playing during our prime time years of covering tennis, right? I would say. But when I was looking at the head-to-heads, you know, it was really interesting because Djokovic leads the head-to-head 27 to, I believe, 23, if I'm reading my notes correctly, 50 matches between them between 2006 and 2020. Djokovic leads 11-6 in Grand Slam matches. Now, Federer led in the rivalry earlier, between 2006 and 2010, he was ahead 13-6. But by 2015, that rivalry was tied 22-22. And also Rafael Nadal against Federer. They played 40 times, and Nadal leads head-to-head 24-16. Interesting. I would have thought maybe Federer had the edge in both, but not the case.
No, I mean, and I think that's, you know, one of the arguments people talk about the GOAT. I'm not a big believer in the GOAT, greatest of all time in tennis in general, because of the historical disparities that exist between the guys who played in the era before tennis went open. Guys like Ken Rosewall, who missed, you know, 10 years of Grand Slam tournaments, would have certainly won many, many if he'd been able to play. A lot of great players like Jack Kramer in the past, Pancho Gonzalez, hardly played much, you know, Grand Slam tennis at all. That's become the coin of the realm now. That's how we judge everybody. But ultimately, I think what you can judge is this era of tennis. And I think these guys have gone at it as three rivals probably never have in the history of tennis, in this sort of three-way thing. And let's face it, Roger doesn't have the edge in those rivalries. There's explanations for it. You talk about Nadal's head-to-head edge. A lot of that becomes because he was playing Roger on clay. Roger was the second-best clay court player in the world for a long time and was running into Nadal deep in clay court tournaments. A lot of that is because of that. And actually, in recent years, he's managed to change the flow of that rivalry and win more than he's lost. But to have the two guys that really are his main litmus tests and not have an advantage against either one of them, he is the older. He's, you know, 5 years older than Rafa and Novak. So he wasn't necessarily playing them in his prime as long as they've been playing him in their prime. And it speaks to Roger's longevity. But it's very poignant. You think about it. Roger passed Pete Sampras' Grand Slam record about 10 years after, you know, Pete did it. And Pete was blown away by how fast that was. Roger's record is being passed while he's still active, which is amazing. And he had blown past Pete's by six and with the 20 Grand Slam singles titles. So that's been tough for him to handle, I'm sure. I think in a lot of ways, you can't call Roger the GOAT if you're talking about pure tennis terms. I don't think it's possible at this point. But you can look at the whole package, which is interesting. And if you look at what he's done for the game, the kind of pleasure he's brought to fans worldwide, what he's done on the business side, I think what he will do in the coming years with his foundation and things like that, you know, he might, in the terms of the whole package, deserve that title.
Have you talked to Roger about, have you had that GOAT conversation? And if so, what are his thoughts? Does he think he's the great, has he ever said, I am the greatest player ever in the history of tennis?
You know, all three of those guys, I've talked about them, about that with them all in different interviews, and they've talked about it in news conferences too. I think they all don't want to be the one who makes that distinction. They want to make the best case that they can, and they let other people decide. But I did ask Roger once about the records and the Grand Slam records and things like that. And he also held the number one record for a long time, most weeks at number one on the ATP. And those are meaningful records in the sport of tennis. And he said, you know, of course, you know, you're happy to have them, but really the joy and the real meaning comes in the moment that you break something. That moment of experience, of that elation, that sense of accomplishment, in that real-time moment, that's where the power of it is for me. That was his thought. Call it a rationalization if you like, but it makes a lot of sense to me. I don't think it's the same satisfaction, the same high 15, 20 years later when your thing's still around. So, you know, at least he's had the moment. You could have made the argument at one time during his career that he was the GOAT, and he was the best player of this era without a doubt. He had proven that. He's not anymore, I don't think, but he had that time and that spot.
Isn't it interesting? He did have that time. And during that time, particularly during that run where he won the five U.S. Open titles, I covered each one of those championships, you would have thought there would have been nobody who could have taken that title from him. But here, all of a sudden, they're all sharing 20. And we're talking in the middle of the second week of the U.S. Open. Novak Djokovic has the opportunity to get to 21. Obviously, he has to win and get to the finals and win that one. But what would Roger say about that? Have you talked to him about the possibility of Djokovic getting to 21 and winning a calendar career Grand Slam?
No, I don't think I've talked about that with him specifically, but we definitely have talked about how impressive a Grand Slam would be. I don't really get into this calendar year Grand Slam or non-calendar year Grand Slam. It's only a Grand Slam for me. That's, you do the four in the calendar year. That was the bar. That's the way it was set for years. That's the way it should be interpreted. So this is the Grand Slam he's going for. Roger's never been close, and neither has Rafa. Believe it or not, neither one of them's ever won even two in a row. And here is Novak with three and three matches away. So I think as a tennis player and a guy who knows the history of the game, which Roger does, I think he has to tip his hat to that and admire it. Is he as close to Novak as he is to Rafa? No, he's not. And this is certainly a maybe a little bit of an edge to it for him. But I think, you know, Roger did this to himself in a way, because if he hadn't been so dominant, hadn't set the bar so high, and these young guys came up behind with ambition, like Nadal and Djokovic, they wouldn't have known where to reach for. And so by him setting the bar where he did, he kind of sowed the seeds of his own historical demise, if you will. And I think that's ultimately, you have to be happy that you've put the sport in a new place and people want to chase it.
Are you surprised that even with Roger Federer not being here, knee issues, Rafael Nadal not here, foot problems, that the fans have not embraced Novak Djokovic with this historic quest as much as they would perhaps if, I know for sure, if Roger were doing it?
No, it's a fair point. I mean, I can't argue with you on that. It's clear from being in the stadium so far in this tournament that people are cheering for his opponents. Part of that is because Novak is number one by a lot. He is by far the biggest men's star and most dominant player in the men's game right now. So, you know, people like underdogs. But that isn't the whole explanation. It's also his style of play, the ability he's had to sort of dominate. People have had such a strong connection to Roger and to Rafa. They're a very tribal sort of thing, especially in the social media age even more. Those tribes are pretty well defined. And I think the fact that he was the one knocking them off the perch did not endear him to their fan bases, which were large. So that plays a role. And I think, you know, ultimately, as this home stretch comes along, I'll be curious because he's still going to be the big favorite and the guys going after him are going to be underdogs. But I do think that people can appreciate the greatness of what he's trying to achieve. And I know as a tennis journalist, I do. I think it would be one of the most extraordinary things I've witnessed. And I mean, I think it's just to do all four in this era, knowing how competitive and global the sport is a tremendous thing. And the guy, you know, love him or not, he is a phenomenal athlete, tennis player who's had longevity, and in many cases tries to do the right thing. Sometimes he's his own worst enemy, but I think he's somebody who has a lot of human value too.
When you look at the top three, when you look at Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic, how do they differ on the court mentally?
Well, I think you have to argue that, you know, the way things are right now, looking at the arc of their whole careers, I mean, Novak is the best finisher in tennis, really. He's really very rarely dropped a match from commanding positions. And I think that speaks to something he's built over time, his tenacity. I always feel like Nadal was sort of hardwired to be a great competitor. He was somebody who played it point by point in a way that so few athletes are able to do, able to compartmentalize it, able to forget what just happened thinking about what was going to happen and be right there in the battle each shot, each rally. So that's his defining quality. I think Novak's acquired that. And I think Roger is, I think, probably more of a momentum player, somebody who really rides the waves of what he's doing when he's in the flow and things are coming to him in patches. He's able to ride those parts of the match and really ride that. But he's not somebody who's been able to hold the leads as often as Novak and Rafa have.
Let's talk about Roger as a businessman and also getting so involved with the politics of tennis. He was the president of the ATP for many, many years, which is so unusual. Pete Sampras even pointed out, listen, when I played, we wouldn't even thought about doing that. It would be too distracting from our games. But it's uncanny that he got so involved with the politics and with the ATP, don't you think?
It is surprising, because that generation before, like Pete Sampras said, with Agassi and Boris Becker and Stefan Edberg, those guys weren't involved with that, really. They felt that was something that would take away their edge and drain them. Roger gradually got more and more interested in it. He was the president of the ATP Player Council, not the ATP, but the Player Council, which is, you know, the guys who come together as active players and spend their time in meeting rooms before Wimbledon or the U.S. Open and talk over the issues of the game. That became a really, you know, important job for a while there back in the 2010s when he was sort of at his peak because they were trying to fight for more prize money from the Grand Slams. Roger's not a confrontational person, not somebody who likes conflict, doesn't like controversy, doesn't thrive on it. So he does a lot of his work behind the scenes. He's sort of somebody who will, you know, meet you over a cup of coffee or in a meeting room with the leaders of the sport and try to work it through in that way. That's his approach. And I think he was pretty successful. They managed to get quite a lot of concessions from them, and prize money went up a lot at the Slams, and that has a lot to do with his leadership. Lately, it's been a more confrontational situation with Novak Djokovic starting a new player group and a lot of sort of frustration, some of it caused by the pandemic. So I'm not sure this is Roger's time. He's still on the council. He's still involved. I think he's working more behind the scenes, whereas there are some big forces at work that are taking the sport potentially in some new directions. So I'm not sure that right now he's as front and center as he's been in the past, but he's somebody who will work in the shadows. And as far as his business, I mean, he had a slow start for a long time. I think he was underpaid for how good he was. He went for a while without an agent. His first Nike contract, which I discovered right in the book, couldn't get it renewed, not even close to what he thought it was worth. His agent told him he should wait. His father said he should take it because he needed the money. Ended up, I think, being underpaid for several years and bringing the whole market down. And then he signed on with IMG and Tony Gatzik, his agent, around 2004, 2005. And things have changed considerably since then.
Tony has done a great job for him, but a lot of these decisions are really made by Roger and his family. Roger's very involved and wants everything run by him. And those business instincts are so important when you're running, you know, an empire like that, right? Your thoughts about Roger as a businessman and where it's all going?
Well, I think a lot of athletes in their active part of their careers, especially early active parts of their careers, they just delegate everything. And it really comes down to the quality of people that you pick. He's a bit different, either because of his parents or because of his own instincts. He wanted to have some control there, and he wanted to have some understanding. And so he really made an effort to try to get into the weeds a little bit in a way that I don't think very many top-level athletes do. And to go without an agent is really unusual when you're sort of number one in the world in that range, which is what he was back in 2003, 2004, 2005. And he really tried to understand the forces at work. You know, who had the keys to the money, who were the sponsors and what they were trying to achieve, what do they want to get out of this? And I think that has really stood him in good stead because it's allowed him to get involved on a very personal level with people that were helping grow the sport, helping grow his own portfolio. He's got some great connections with these guys who are high-level sponsors. A lot of them are Swiss multinationals, and he's been somebody who has taken a very active personal role in a lot of that stuff. And I think he's found out that he likes learning about how the business works behind the scenes, and I think that's something he will be involved with as he goes forward as well. And obviously Tony Gatzik's handling a lot of this stuff as his agent. But Roger likes to know what's going on, and I think he's somebody who, when young players ask him for advice, he told me this, he says, know your own stuff. Understand what's happening to you. It's ultimately your responsibility. And I think that's great advice for all of us, as somebody who doesn't enjoy doing his taxes, in my case. So I think there's a lot to take away from that for young athletes.
Absolutely. We have to give credit to Mirka, his wife, a former competitive tennis player herself, who really handled a lot of his business affairs for a long time, right? And media appointments.
I don't know about the business side so much. I know she was involved in some of the meetings and negotiations early on, and I think she's still, you know, at the table for big decisions that come along, people that are going to be important in Roger's business life. I'm sure she wants to meet them and know what's going on. But yeah, she was involved. Her career ended prematurely, sadly. Big foot injury. I think would have been a top 20, 30 player potentially. She was very, very good, very driven. And I think she channeled, you know, Rogers told me this, she channeled and lived vicariously. And he was happy for her to do that for a while with his career and helping him become as great as he could be. And that gave her a lot of pleasure and satisfaction. Things have obviously changed. They have four children now. She has a pretty busy life away from his life on the court. But I know she has supported all his decisions all the way through, whatever had to be done. Sacrifices had to be made, and she didn't really even view them as sacrifices because of the way she was raised. So I don't think Roger would have lasted as long or been as great for as long as he has been if he didn't have a player and a person behind him like Mirka.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at his team, from his coaches to his trainers, I mean, there's a lot of luck involved, too. Just picking the right person, obviously good instincts, and knowing who to stay with, you know, when it comes to personnel and you know, a wife and that kind of thing. So, but he's had a lot of good fortune as well, just as far as timing and people who came into his life. Tony, Gatzik, obviously. And I want to talk a little bit about Roger Federer and Tiger, because Tiger Woods, there's a lot of parallels there with the fame and with, you know, Tiger being at the top of his game for so long, Roger dominating tennis for a number of years there. What are your thoughts? I know Roger thought that Tiger was a mentor to him at some point. Is that true?
I'm not sure. A mentor might be not the right word, but I think a reference point for sure. I mean, I think Roger's sort of somebody who often, I'm not saying all the time, but he has something he's interested in or progress he wants to make, he can find somebody who can, you know, kind of give him the keys to that or help him understand what lies ahead. And in Tiger's case, Tiger was a megastar, obviously, at the point in time when they met, back in that 2005-2006 period. And both with IMG, their agents knew each other. Roger's not much of a golf fan. Nadal is, but not Roger. And I think Tiger keeps track of tennis, and he knew about Roger and followed him. So they were curious about each other, and they connected. And I remember they celebrated one of Roger's U.S. Open victories in the locker room, but they had met that day, and a lot of it was through their agents that it happened, but it was, I think, a legitimate curiosity. And I think for a while there, they did have connections and talk about sort of things they could only relate to themselves, because they were in this position of dominating, trying to sustain the dominance and find the keys to holding on to that interest and that zeal within themselves. And I know that they did talk a lot, but I think that sort of faded, and I don't think Roger was a big part of Tiger's life after the big scandals that came along. And they were close, I think, with Tiger's ex-wife, so that made it a little more complicated as well. But I know that they both took pleasure and meaning in being able to have a discussion with somebody that could really look them in the eye and relate to them.
In an ironic twist, though, even though they were friends, you know, with Tiger's scandal developing, here's Roger, who seemed to be, you know, this great role model. And it might have even helped Roger from a marketing standpoint and a sponsorship standpoint at one point. Do you agree?
Yeah, Max Eisenbud, who's been IMG for a long time, runs our tennis division now, was Maria Sharapova's agent. He talked to me for the book, and he made a good point. It's true. So I think when the Tiger thing happened, Tiger was so big, had so many sponsorships, and was such a major factor in global sport. When that kind of all fell apart in terms of the image, the sponsors became very, very gun-shy, and they were very concerned about where they put their money, and a lot of them wanted to avoid athletes in general for a little while, according to Max. But Roger was so clean, and the image was so good, they felt that it was a safe haven. So I think ultimately, Max would say this, and he's, you know, in the business, I'm not, that it did help Roger. It wasn't in any way intentional on Roger's part or Tony's part, but they were able to benefit from the fact that there was this desire for a really, you know, smooth, clean, safe athlete who was excellent and would give people a pretty much sure place to place their bet, because Tiger had, I'd say, burned the sponsors, but had made them very gun shy.
A couple last questions here. All the hours you spent interviewing Roger and all the time you spent traveling with him and watching him play through the years, what surprised you the most in doing this book about Roger Federer?
I think you talked about luck before, Ann, a little bit, and how that has played a role in his life. It plays a role in all of our lives, let's face it. I mean, who do you meet, the end up marrying, you know, what career do you get into, all these different things that come along. A lot of it has to do with sort of a moment where things are kind of hanging in the balance and you make a choice, right? I think I was really surprised to go back to that early period in Roger's career, about 1998. He won the Wimbledon junior title, to about 2003 when he won Wimbledon for the first time, his first Grand Slam title. That's a five-year period. And that period, a lot of things had to happen. I discovered or rediscovered for him to become what he became. And it was by no means a sure thing. And it was hanging by a thread a couple different times, either through the financial aspects of things or through the death of his coach, Peter Carter, his boyhood coach, which was a tragedy that really shaped Roger, but it could have taken him in a different direction. And also just his ability to master himself. All the processes that he went through, there was a lot of work he did on himself. A lot of people he picked well and made the right choice, but there was also a really strong element of luck in there too. People that he met at the right time, a choice that he made, things that happened just when they needed to happen for him to go forward. And I think that was instructive to me. Yes, you make your own luck to some degree, but you have to have some. And I feel like he did a hell of a job of, when he had it, taking advantage of it.
Interesting. Where is he now, status-wise, with his game? Will he come back, and can he continue to be one of the top players in the world?
Can he come back? I mean, medical science being what it is and his motivation being what it is, sure he can come back. Can he come back and be a guy winning Grand Slams again? I just don't see it. I think it's really hard to see it at this point. He's 40 years old. He's having another knee operation. This is not a sport like the NFL where you can drop back and throw a pass downfield. You have to run all the time, repeatedly for hours upon hours on different surfaces. It's a grind, quick surface changes. These young guys are getting better. Novak's still very motivated. I just don't see him seeing enough positives in it to make the decision to come back. I could be wrong. He may want a better resolution than he got at Wimbledon this year when he lost in the quarter 6-love in the final set to Hubie Hurkacz. I could understand that. But I'm not sure he's going to get a better end game at this point. But that's okay. He's had an amazing run. He's been a reference point for 20 years in world sport, in a very competitive sport. So I think he should sleep pretty well at night.
Do you think he's happy with it? You said you're kind of projecting that you think he's happy with it. But is Roger Federer happy with, look, he's 40 years old, Djokovic's 34, Rafa Nadal's 35. You know, he had an incredible career. When all is said and done, and as well as you know Roger Federer, do you think if he hung it up right now, do you think the 20 Grand Slam titles and his incredible career on and off the court is just incredible for him, or does he still want more?
He may want more. I don't think he's going to get more is what I think at this point. And I think he's a smart enough guy. I think unless something just really fabulous happens with this operation and he comes back and just feels like he's 25 again, I'm not saying it can't happen, but I think he's going to have to be honest with himself and realize what is he really trying to achieve. If he wants to come back out there and have the sensation of communing with the public again a few more times and get that joy out of it, sure. And who's to begrudge him that? I mean, ultimately, he's made his own choices and they worked out very well for him. I just don't see him. What's driven him is, yes, the communion with the public, but really what's driven him is the ability to compete at the highest level for major titles. I think those days are done myself. It may be hard for him to realize that, and it may take him time to realize that. But again, I think it's okay because I feel like the guy, yes, this era, we've seen more and more athletes last longer. They all feed off each other. But tennis is a tough sport. I mean, it's a movement-driven sport and a reflex-driven sport. And it is a sport where you're exposed out there. You're on your own. You know, you have nobody to help you on the court, nowhere to hide. And so I think it's for him to be able to be as good as he's been for so long and remain relevant for so long is a huge achievement.
Huge achievement. Huge achievement, Christopher. And when you talk about Tiger Woods and people trying to make the comparisons, Tiger coming back after all those back surgeries in 2019 and winning the Masters, which was extraordinary, so magical. But we're talking about two different sports. I mean, tennis is so physical. Golf is physical, too. Obviously, you need a good back and you know, limbs at work. But you can't compare the two.
Well, the only thing is Roger had that moment, too. It comes on a different timeline in tennis. You're not going to get the Phil Mickelson. You're not going to win a Grand Slam at 50 years old. You're not going to get the Tiger at the Masters at that stage. But Roger came back in 2017. He was in his mid-30s, which was considered kind of ancient at that time for tennis players. And he won 3 more Grand Slam titles. He beat Nadal at the Australian Open, we talked about in 2017. Wimbledon again, hit number one at age 36. So he had that moment. I don't think he's going to get another one like that. But maybe if it's to him to go back to Wimbledon and feel healthy, which he didn't feel this year, I don't think, and play pain-free and hear the roars of the crowd, who's to begrudge him that? I can't, but he's not winning.
And there you have it, said by Christopher Clary, author of The Master, The Long Run and Beautiful Game of Roger Federer. Christopher, thanks so much. I appreciate the time, and just a real joy to read the book and to know you. Thanks so much.
And thank you. It's always a pleasure.